The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Between World War II and 2011, as many as 100,000 service members were less than honorably discharged for being gay. It was, Dave Phillips writes in the New York Times, a kind of scarlet letter that barred them from any benefits and scarred their civilian lives. Now, 4 years after the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, gay vets are requesting an upgrade to their status. A bill in Congress would restore benefits to nearly all of them, but the bill has been stalled since 2013, and the road to restitution for many discharged veterans has not been easy. Dave Phillips is military correspondent for the New York Times and wrote about the issue. And Dave, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So you talked to several former service members who had been less than honorably discharged or discharged as a Class II homosexual. Now, what did that mean for them?
It essentially means that you're kicked out of the Army or whatever service you serve in. And when that happens, there's a lot of things that can affect you for the rest of your life. The most important of them is that you are then barred from getting veterans' benefits in almost all cases. Health care, help with loans, education benefits, all the things that we as a society have set up to help people transition from the military, they don't get. And for a lot of them, that affected them when they were kicked out when they were younger. But then now, decades later, again, as they maybe start to need care from the VA, affects them again.
And in their personal civilian lives, some of those effects went even more deep. What are some of those cases?
Well, you know, what was really striking for me when I began speaking to these folks, some of whom were kicked out in the 50s and early 60s, was that, you know, oftentimes they were growing up in pretty conservative rural places, and they were joining the military not knowing necessarily that they were gay, and a lot of times had their first gay experiences in the military. And so, you know, all of a sudden they're going through this very perplexing self-discovery, and at that point they get essentially prosecuted for it. I mean, they were kicked out. They weren't charged with crimes, but they were shunned. They were sent away. They were often outed by the government to their family and communities, and they had their identity as a young service member stripped from them. And then they went home to areas where oftentimes they were required to show employers their military records, which, you know, said right on them that they had been kicked out for being gay. So it was a really hard thing for a lot of people to get over. And so many I talked to just buried it in various ways and tried to move on and never speak of it again.
Many have passed away in this day and age, but still, how many service members are potentially eligible to get their discharge status upgraded?
We really don't know how many over the decades were kicked out in this way. There are some pretty good estimates that put it at somewhere around 100 to 120,000. You know, it may be more. We just don't know because the record keeping was not very good, and no one has really tried to dig back deep into it.
How has the U.S. military's punishment or treatment of homosexuality changed over the years, you know, going back to the beginning of the Republic?
Well, you know, what's astounding is that Homosexual acts have always been barred by the United States military. There are court-martial documents that are signed by General George Washington that show he kicked a young officer out for being gay and literally had him drummed out of the fort, followed by a fife and drum troop. And for generations afterwards, it was treated as a misconduct offense, something that you could be court-martialed for or kicked out of the service for. And then right around World War II, the military changed how it viewed homosexuality and started looking at it instead of as a crime or a misdeed. They started viewing it as almost like an innate defect, something that they could screen for in the same way they screen for flat feet or bad vision and try and keep out of the force. Now, effectively, it was the same thing. If you were gay, you were not allowed to serve. You were often drummed out in very unpleasant ways, but people were no longer court-martialed for it. Instead, they got these quick discharges that would be either undesirable, is what they called it, an undesirable discharge, or a less than honorable discharge. But the effect was the same. They were out of their chosen career, and they were often stripped of their benefits.
And then after the war and the charged environment of the Cold War, how did things change?
There was this idea that started in the Cold War that homosexuals were dangerous to national security, that somehow they could get blackmailed for being gay and give away government secrets. And so starting in the 50s, there was a concerted effort to hunt down and drive out gays from the military. And usually the investigators that took this on, they worked in pairs, and they would identify people and bring them into, you know, a small interrogation room, the type of thing you see in a bad old police movie, and just, you know, give them the good cop, bad cop for a couple hours and threaten them. One veteran I talked to, the investigators had gone through his room and gotten his address book, and they essentially told him, look, confess and name names, or we're going to call everybody here in your address book at work and tell them, you know, that you're gay. And what's amazing to me is that that process really, from my interviews, it seems to have stayed unchanged throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even into the 80s, where, you know, I think in civilian life it would have been seen as inappropriate. But in the military, there was still very much an edict to identify gays and get them out.
I'm speaking with Dave Phillips. He's military correspondent for The New York Times, and he wrote about a number of less than honorably discharged service members who were kicked out for being gay. Now, after Don't Ask, Don't Tell, they are looking for benefits and to reinstate their status. 4 years after the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, will they automatically be granted honorable status?
Any veteran who wants to correct their discharge and get an honorable discharge can essentially send a form into Washington and ask that this be done. And unless there's some underlying other misconduct that the Pentagon identifies, the policy is to upgrade, to give these folks their honorable discharge. But there's a lot of red tape that they have to go through, the process of getting old records so that you can show how you were discharged. The process of getting that approved can take easily more than a year. And so there has been an effort to say, hey, look, we as a society should just grant a blanket upgrade to all these people, simplify the process, you know, let them get what was due to them. And that proposal, which is in the form of a bill in Congress, is just stuck right now in essentially Congress being Congress. I think that it's seen as sort of a partisan bargaining chip that's not going anywhere anytime soon.
So the bill would, of course, add a lot of veterans to the roles of those who are already due or hoping to get benefits. Any ideas on how much it would cost to add all of these additional service people to the role of those due veterans benefits?
I don't think the issue has even evolved that far. I think that the people that are coming forward now are a relatively small number compared to what we think is out there. I think that the government hasn't made any sort of estimates about how many might come forward and what it might cost. You know, certainly there is some cost involved in it, but there's probably cost involved in keeping the status quo as well.
So of those that you spoke to, what does this restitution of status mean for them?
With the veterans that I talked to, getting their discharge upgraded was not a matter of trying to get benefits. It was more a matter of trying to regain their sense of decency and respect, to demand to the government and society that had done this to them to acknowledge its mistake and to grant them the courtesy of honor that they had never had before. And that is really what astounded me about this, that someone could carry around shame for decades, you know, a very unpleasant, heavy load of shame, and then be able to put it down and ask for respect, I thought was really a moving thing. And I think that's what's motivating a lot of these guys.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for sharing those stories with us.
Thank you for having me on.
David Phillips, he's a military correspondent for the New York Times, and that's where we found his article, "Ousted as Gay, Aging Veterans Are Battling Again for Honorable Discharges." And you'll find a link to read the article for yourself. It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Exuberant crowds are welcoming Pope Francis on his first ever visit to the United States. The Pope has won fans with displays of humility and forgiveness and by shirking traditional Vatican pomposity and judgment. He's managed to adhere to Catholic dogma while introducing progressive causes, attracting a following among devout and lapsed Catholics, non-Catholics, and even committed non-believers like the comedian Bill Maher. It's not a line easily straddled in pop culture, but the self-deprecating comedian Jim Gaffigan is one who's pulling it off. The writer Ruth Graham is a frequent contributor to Slate and to the Boston Globe. In her ranking of America's top Christian comedians, Jim Gaffigan is king. And Ruth, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about Jim Gaffigan's comedy and career.
So he's been sort of rising, I don't even want to say rising slowly, but he's been on the scene for at least a decade now. And I want to be careful to say, you know, he's a comedian who's a Christian rather than a Christian comedian, because Christian comedy is sort of its own genre, which we can talk about later. And Jim Gaffigan is very much a mainstream comedian. So he's, you know, he's like in with the cool comedians and he's on all the late night talk shows and is, you know, palling around with Chris Rock and that sort of thing. So he has all this mainstream comedy credibility. But at the same time, he's really open about talking about his Catholic faith in his stand-up and even in interviews. He's making jokes about the Pope, making jokes about church, about going to church. And so it's kind of this interesting, it's a neat trick to pull off, I would say, to be sort of an open, you know, devout Catholic and also kind of a cool guy, stand-up comedian.
He has a television show as well, doesn't he?
He does. So that debuted this summer, and that was really what kind of crystallized this for me. It's called The Jim Gaffigan Show, and it's based on his life. So the main character, Jim Gaffigan, is a comedian living in New York City, and he has five kids in a small apartment, and that's a big part of Gaffigan's stand-up, too, that he has a big family and a growing family, probably, as a devout Catholic. But the show is interesting because, you know, again, the character is a believer, a somewhat reluctant believer, but they'll have their priest over for dinner, and, you know, there are scenes that take place in church, and it also kind of gets at this I don't want to call it a trick, but this aspect of Gaffigan's humor, which I think is really interesting, which is that he plays a somewhat progressive Christian, or he is a somewhat progressive Christian, but it's couched in these jokes about overeating and about being this beleaguered family man. So it's sort of, it's located in this tradition of sort of conservative political topics, but yet he goes out of his way to make clear that he's not anti-gay and that he's sort of not a traditional, stereotypical Christian in a lot of ways.
Well, I thought it was even funny to take up the ranking of Christian comedians. It's not really a crowded field, is it?
It's not at all. So really the only other big one I had in mind in terms of, you know, Christians who are comedians in the mainstream space was Stephen Colbert. who, again, it's really interesting because the Colbert Report was obviously pretty progressive politically, and Colbert himself is this pretty outspoken Catholic. And it's not that that combination is so uncommon in the real world to be a progressive Christian, but it's really not how pop culture depictions of Christianity usually run. But Colbert has been really outspoken. I mean, he recently gave this interview to GQ, really moving, talking about how his faith has sustained him. And he lays out this pretty complex theology of suffering and talks about how the context of his existence is that he's here to know God, to love God, to serve God. So, I mean, in my book, you know, I personally prefer Colbert to Gaffigan just in terms of humor, but I think he's a little bit tough for a lot of Christians to fully get on board with just because he is seen as so progressive politically. So it's a little bit of a tough combination. Whereas Jim Gaffigan is hugely popular among conservatives, not only conservatives, but I think that his sort of wheelhouse of his jokes about eating and family and things like that are a little easier to swallow.
We eat, you know, because we want to have a good time. Really, that's all a vacation is, just us eating in a place we've never been. Well, why don't we eat something, then we'll go and get something to eat. And we'll see that thing we're supposed to see. They probably got a snack bar there, right? After that, we should probably get something to eat, though. Then we'll eat something.
Well, does he win by being able to cross over into a non-Christian specific audience? You know, like Amy Grant in pop music, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's exactly how I see it. Although he didn't even rise up through. I mean, there is this whole world of Christian comedy where these comedians perform in churches to really huge crowds. And there are DVD specials, like there's like the Apostles of Comedy DVD special and Thou Shalt Laugh and things like that, which is not how Gaffigan came up. I mean, he came up in a really traditional way through traditional comedy channels. But I would still say that the frequency with which he talks about his faith and the openness that he talks about it, you know, to me, he is a Christian comedian.
But those would be jokes for insiders, I'm guessing.
Exactly. Right? And it's really hard to even evaluate. I mean, you can find a lot of this on YouTube. And I was thinking about, you know, is it fair to say that this is funny comedy? It's obviously so subjective. And it really is. I mean, these are jokes for, you know, for the in crowd. It's sort of this whole parallel comedy circuit for a very specific audience. And it's almost not fair to talk about whether or not it's funny to an outsider.
But I'm thinking that Christian pop culture in general, you know, obviously there's Christian rock, which has made a lot of headway, but it doesn't have a lot of street cred. Let's put it that way.
It really doesn't. And it's this perpetual problem. And I think sort of a perpetual cause of mild pain for a lot of Christians who are pop culture savvy, because there's certainly plenty of them out there, that the culture produced by at least, you know, certain corners of conservative Christianity is sort of perpetually playing catch up to mainstream culture. So I just was, you know, reading something about Christian Fashion Week, which is all about modesty and, you know, not terribly stylish if you click through and look at it. And yeah, there's Christian music, Christian comedy, Christian movies, and it, you know, in some of these areas they're catching up, but it's certainly not a source that you know, a non-believer would go to for the highest quality cultural products.
Well, I'm thinking about the every year there's this festival of, you know, old Jewish jokes that happens in New York City, carrying on the old Catskill traditions of the self-deprecating religious comedian. So this isn't really a new thing, is it?
It's not. And Jim Gaffigan certainly does that sort of self-deprecating shtick. And that even is a strain, believe it or not, within Christian comedy, where a lot of these stand-up comics will kind of poke fun at an imaginary, even more conservative audience member being aghast at their, you know, at their jokes, which even, you know, are pretty mild jokes. And there's no reason that that couldn't sort of flourish in Christianity, but I think American Christianity at least has a reputation for, you know, almost sort of an enforced optimism that maybe doesn't mesh well with at least, you know, trends in comedy within the last few decades.
Well, what do you think Pope Francis would think of your pick for the top Christian comedian in America?
Well, I hope he'd be happy with it. I mean, I see Jim Gaffigan in some ways as kind of a typical American Catholic, where there's discomfort with some aspects of it, but ultimately, you know, a loyal and loving believer.
It doesn't matter if you're religious or not. Does anything make you feel more uncomfortable than some stranger going, "I'd like to talk to you about Jesus"? Yeah, I'd like you not to. You could say that to the Pope. "I want to talk to you about Jesus." You'd be like, "Easy, freak. I keep work at work." I have to admit, that was a good impression of the Pope.
Ruth Graham is a frequent contributor to Slate and to the Boston Globe. There's a link to read her article in Slate about why Jim Gaffigan is America's top Christian comedian. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Forgery in the art industry is not rare, but a con artist who has been caught and never sent to jail is. Meet Mark Landis. For more than 30 years, he's been imitating works of art that range from Picasso's to Mary Cassatt's to Dr. Seuss, and donating them to more than 46 museums in 20 states. The documentary, Art and Craft, gives us a glimpse of Landis, the mischievous shut-in and skilled artist who played the role of philanthropist and the curator who's bent on stopping him. Jennifer Grossman and Sam Coleman directed the film, and it's making its television debut on PBS's POV series this Friday. Jennifer and Sam, it's so nice to have you with us. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
So how would you describe Mark Landis?
Mark is not like anyone I've ever met before. And, you know, when we first read the article in the Times that sort of inspired us to make the film, we didn't know what to expect. You know, then spent some time on the phone with Mark and met him in person. And he was not like what you would imagine an art forger running from the law might be. You know, he was charming and funny and constantly referencing old movies and television shows. And he's pretty wonderful. So,
but let's talk a little bit about his technique. Now, you follow him to Hobby Lobby and Kinko's, where he gets his supplies. Now, here is Mark Landis from the film talking about his techniques that have duped museum curators across the country.
Put it in one of those Walmart frames. Looks like $1 million. It does look like $1 million because actually that's worth about $1 million. Maybe not quite that much, but close. And these frames are so cheap, and all you have to do is just go over them some with arts and crafts stuff, and they look really good. Don't you think that looks good?
So that's a clip from Art and Craft. We're speaking with the filmmakers Jennifer Grossman and Sam Coleman about the art forger Mark Landis. It sounds like he's playing us a little. I mean, or is he a little proud of himself? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely some pride there. It's, you know, Mark... As we got to know him more, you know, I think one of the things you realize about him is that there's this incredible mischievousness. It's not a maliciousness, but it is a mischievousness. And I think he took pride and enjoyment out of putting one over on folks with materials that, you know, are so common and so cheap. And he is unusual for so many different reasons. But this in particular, I think, is incredibly unusual for an art forger to not obsess about the materials and the means of production. You know, he was using cheap stuff because for Mark, it wasn't really about having, you know, the pieces have any sort of longevity in people's homes or the sale or any of these things. He was giving them away really for that moment of that interaction. So he could get in there, have that interaction with people and get away. And after that, he really didn't care. So, you know, if there was scrutiny afterwards to find the pigments were fluorescing under a blue light because they actually weren't period specific or whatever, it didn't matter to him.
And that's why he isn't in jail, is that correct? Because he never asked for money for these. He just gave them away.
Yeah. He didn't ask for money. He never took a tax write-off. This wasn't a planned intent to avoid the law. It just was, you know, it wasn't his interest.
Well, Mark Landis' father was a military officer. His family traveled a lot. He's pretty much obsessed with his mother and very much a product of the media age. Jennifer, you mentioned him always doing quotes from films. And in the film, we see the TV is always playing in the background. He's got loads of movie quotes. And you played on that with film clips throughout your film. How does this kind of illuminate his character? How did you use those?
As we began spending more time with Mark and then began watching the footage with co-director and editor Mark Becker, it became clear that Mark Landis's sort of whole world reference, you know, came through these old movies and television shows. It's such an important part of his life, and so we felt like it really should infuse the film as well. And, you know, it really, the TV is constantly on. It still is, you know, if we call him on the phone, he has to turn the TV down. And so I think using these clips were just a wonderful way to get into his head.
Well, Mark Landis had been diagnosed, he tells you early in the film, that he was hospitalized as early as age 17 and a long history of mental illness. Now, here he is reading his diagnosis. This is from a psych ward.
Schizophrenic, paranoid, and psychotic disorders. I got that. Personality disorders. I got that. Catatonic or other grossly disorganized behavior. I guess I've got that, too. It says I've got it. Incoherence. Well, wait a minute. I didn't mean to laugh. I just, gee, that's awful. Oddities of thought, perception, speech, and behavior. Oh, no, I don't have that.
So he knows himself to a degree. Do you think that this art forgery was designed as a, I don't know, a way for him to cope with his mental illness?
I mean, I think certainly, you know, he taught himself to draw at an early age when he was a young child, and copying images out of catalogs from museums was a way for him to entertain himself when he was alone at night, and it was something he had a really good facility for. So within that background, you know, I think he really finds copying to be soothing, and he also, I think the art is both therapeutic, and then it's a means to an end in terms of, you know, getting to meet people through it.
Well, there is also this sense of humor. You know, there's an incredibly, as you said, he's charming, he's likable. There's a kind of gentleness to him and a lot of sympathy that I felt a lot of sympathy for him, and then thought, well, you know, it's kind of it's not a victimless crime to donate art to museums, passing them off as real. But there is a part of me that thinks, well, those curators, you know, they didn't know. I mean, we see in the film, you could have done something as easy as pulling up a blue light. But as we hear in the film from one curator,
he brought up very quickly was that there were more paintings and possible endowments from the family's estate. He knew right where to hit us. Our soft spot, art and money.
He's lying to people, right? You know, in this case, one museum curator, they're all across the country that have been completely taken. And he knows how to hit them, that soft spot, art and money, which is exactly what a con artist does. But he presents his intentions as really pure. What do you think? Are his intentions pure?
Pure is a sort of a difficult word. I think there's a purity in anyone's intent as long as there is sort of no self-delusion. I think Mark is aware of how, at times, this ruse that he perpetrated was delusional. In other words, he talks openly in the film and in person as a human being that he would get carried away in this act. You know, I think he understands that what he did wasn't above board or necessarily right, but he sort of sees it as sort of harmless mischief and the kind of thing that for him gave him meaning, and so therefore this was his way in and his way to communicate with people. And but certainly he does not see it the same way that, say, Matthew Leininger did, the person that, you know, discovered the ruse and sort of continued to track the case. You know, Matthew sees this as, you know, fully a wrong deed. You know, Mark sees it in more gray.
Well, and in the film, you present there, you know, Matthew Leininger is his kind of Javert, you know, chasing him down. He discovers the ruse, relentlessly trying to stop him. And you play these two off each other with this kind of noirish caper music, you know, revealing their shared obsessive qualities. So are you asking viewers to question here, you know, who is the good guy? Who's the bad guy?
I think what we wanted to do is start with ideas of people that, you know, face value maybe, and then deepen them as the course of the movie went on. And certainly this isn't a movie where we like to tell people what to think. And, you know, we've gotten reactions from one end of the spectrum to the other in terms of, you know, who thinks who is the villain and the good guy and who gets what out of the film. And some people find it hilarious and other people find it touching. That's been gratifying in that I think the work that Sam and Mark Becker and I put into crafting the film, you know, has allowed for people to question things that they might not necessarily question.
I'm curious, which one of them did you meet first? And did they know that you were in contact with the other?
We got in touch with Matt first. He was a lot easier to find. And we had a great interview with him. And then after that, you know, we realized there was definitely a story here. And so we got in touch with Mark. And they did know that we were in touch with each other and filming with each other.
Well, this is all sort of building up to a meeting between the two of them. There's an exhibition of Mark's work. It's curated by Aaron Cowan at the University of Cincinnati, where they do meet. Now, did you know they were going to meet when you first started filming?
No, we didn't. But interestingly enough, as Jennifer said, Matthew was our first interview and first, you know, moment of filming for this project. And in the interview is a line that he says, he told us that he had this dream that he would put together an exhibition of Mark Landis's known forgeries and invite the world to come see them and invite Mark as the guest of honor. And he sort of laughs. And, you know, we sort of stored that in the back of our minds thinking like, wow, that would be amazing if that ever really were to happen. But, you know, we weren't thinking that it would. And, you know, spent the majority of the next year filming with Mark and keeping in touch with Matt. And then suddenly it all came together. Matt became reintroduced to Aaron. They had known each other, worked together previously, and together worked to set up the show. And it happened super fast. And thankfully, because we had already, you know, been introduced to Matt and stayed in touch, we were able to film it.
It must be very hard not to have a kind of expectation of what that scene is going to look like when they meet.
As a filmmaker and a human being,
I think,
you know.
Yes.
I mean, geez, we, you know, there was this moment right beforehand where, you know, it's in the film and we're, you know, hanging out with Mark before he goes to this exhibition. And, you know, our hearts were in our throats as well because, and his was obviously way more because this was Mark's life. But, you know, the expectation was that he was going to be hung, you know, that this was going to be a public hanging in a sort of potential, like, you know, embarrassment for him. And things turned out somewhat differently. And maybe we should just leave it at that.
Well, he does. He has a tremendous anxiety beforehand. It really looks like a panic attack. And I wondered if during all the time that you spent with him, did you witness other maybe less pivotal displays of his illness that maybe you decided not to include? I mean, you spent a lot of time in the film, I think, helping us relate to him and understand him.
I mean, I think, you know, certainly the time we were shooting with Mark, his health was sort of up and down, both and not just his mental health, but his, you know, he wasn't taking such great care of himself. And so we were actually, you know, we were concerned about him and were in touch with Donna, who's in the film, his former caseworker. And, you know, it was interesting because after, you know, this build up to the exhibition, he sort of had this new lease on life. And even since the film, he's really come out of his shell in this way that we never anticipated and has been a lovely surprise, I think, for everyone involved, and that he's really enjoyed the film and the film's reception and talking about the film and traveling with it and getting to meet people all over the country. And so that's been sort of a wonderful byproduct that we didn't expect.
And he's doing his own work. It looks like I'm looking at his website right now. He will commission, you can commission original works, have him copy a photo or a painting of maybe a family member or something like that. So he's signing his own work.
He is signing his own work now. And he's able to communicate with people online through their orders and through sort of comment boxes. And I think it's been really wonderful for him.
That's so ironic that people will want, you know, I want to have a Mark Landis of my own.
Yeah, that's why it's called MarkLandisOriginal.com.
Well, since the film has come out, you both of you and Mark Landis have been on several panels. I know that you, with Colette Lull, presented the film for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and used him as an example of someone managing his mental illness through his artwork. Did you, when you started making this film, think that it would turn into a film about mental illness on some level?
When we first heard about the story, there was no mention of Mark's mental illness. And so, you know, we went in intrigued by the premise of an art forger who's giving away his fakes and wondering why on earth he would do that. And then, you know, once we met Mark and understood his diagnosis a bit and sort of his history, certainly we knew that mental illness was going to be a part of the film, and figuring out how to structure that within the sort of art heist story was something that Sam and Mark Becker and I spent a lot of time debating in the edit room. And we wanted the film to show the Mark Landis that we got to know over several years, which is, you know, not someone who's mentally ill, but he's his own person who happens to have mental illness. And I think that was important for us to convey and has seemed to touch people in the same way that we intended, which has been great.
Well, Jennifer and Sam, congratulations, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you
for having us.
Jennifer Grossman and Sam Coleman directed the film Art and Craft. It dives into the life of the art forger Mark Landis. And it's making its television debut on PBS's POV series this Friday and will be available online for a month after the premiere. More information at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we heard about master forger Mark Landis, who fooled the art world for years by giving his fakes away for free. Most art cons, of course, are in it for the money, hoping to convince galleries and collectors and museums that their knockoffs are worth millions. However, some of the most successful longtime forgers aren't nearly so ambitious. They sell their fakes for just a few bucks a piece. Producer Rebecca Shear discovered a big and costly problem in Alaska: counterfeit native art.
Let's say you're in the market to buy some Alaska native art.
This one here, this is a whalebone.
Can you describe what it is?
This is what we call a whalebone vessel. They usually have this topper on it that is a carved whale's tail or a walrus or, you know, a marine mammal of some kind. Usually.
Now, I wasn't actually in the market to buy Alaska Native art when I visited Carrie Irwin Brown, executive director of the Alaska Native Arts Foundation at the Foundation's Gallery in downtown Anchorage, but I was in the market to learn more about it.
What is that topper made out of?
This is fossilized ivory. You can see the color in the...
More specifically, to learn how to recognize it and know whether or not it's real.
It is very difficult, though, because there are people who carve whalebone, for instance, ivory, and it's shipped here to Alaska, but it may have been carved in the Philippines or overseas somewhere. And in a lot of cases, you wouldn't know the difference other than by knowing the artist.
Counterfeit Alaska Native art isn't a new problem. In 1972, it prompted the Alaska Department of Economic Development to create the Silver Hand Art Authentication Program. But even with 1,500 Silver Hand permit holders out there today, the problem's still growing. Or so says Saunders McNeil.
I'm the Community and Native Arts Program Director with the Alaska State Council on the Arts.
That's the group who administers the Silver Hand Program. When I asked McNeil how widespread counterfeit Alaska Native art is, she told me this.
According to the Federal Trade Commission, it's definitely in the millions of dollars as far as profit loss to individual artists.
And that's partly because counterfeit stuff can sell so cheaply.
Authentic Alaska Native artwork, particularly traditional, tends to go for a far higher price on the consumer market.
For instance, that whalebone vessel Carrie Brown showed me, $750.
Because the materials required to make those traditional art pieces come from subsistence activities. So there's an enormous amount of work and effort that goes behind procuring that material.
Like a doll wearing a seal throat parka. Brown sells one from St. Lawrence Island for $3,900. But cost isn't the only indication that a piece of art might not be all it's cracked up to be. For one thing, consider the feel.
Resin can look a lot like ivory, but has a different temperature feel to it.
Or the markings.
A lack of a signature on larger pieces can be a cue.
Or shopkeepers having documentation on hand.
Most know their native artists very, very well and will be very open to providing you any and all information that you want as a consumer.
And as Carrie Brown explains back at the Alaska Native Arts Foundation Gallery, there's the telltale sign of mass production.
For the most part, Native artists are not equipped to do that because a lot of them are working in their homes. They don't have the studio space. They just aren't able to produce things on that large of a level.
Now, I can tell you with certainty that everything Carrie Brown sells is 100% legit. Her outreach manager travels to villages and deals directly with the artists themselves. The foundation then sells the stuff all over the world. But as for some of its neighboring shops in Anchorage, well,
I went walking last week with a guy we had up from New York, and we walked around to the gift shops, and I would say about 50% of them at least had non-Native made art.
Were they trying to pass them off as Native, or was it pretty much out in the open?
It's not at all out in the open. I think if you asked them, they probably wouldn't tell you that it wasn't Native made.
Isn't that breaking the law?
You would think it is, right?
Yeah, you would, because, well, it is. Remember those millions of dollars we talked about before? Under the 1990 Indian Arts and Crafts Act, a business can be fined up to $1 million if it falsely suggests that an item's been produced by a Native American or Alaska Native. An individual who does so can face civil or criminal penalties up to a $250,000 fine and or 5 years in jail.
I'm still sort of hooked on this idea of what you're saying about all the gift shops here. I didn't realize it was so widespread.
Right here in downtown Anchorage.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of one to send you to. You could see this firsthand. I was appalled.
Now, Carrie Brown's far more of an expert than I am. She's Alaska Native and has been immersed in art for years. But I decided to take her advice and head out to assess the situation for myself.
Hello. Hi. I'm from the Alaska Public Radio Network doing a story about just Alaska Native art.
The guy working at the first shop I visit is surprisingly straightforward.
Alaska Native art? Not really.
No,
most of the stuff's not even really Alaska made.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, everything's just still made in China.
So I move on to another shop, this one brimming with carvings and figurines that look an awful lot like whalebone and ivory and the like, and they don't seem mass-produced, but...
Is it possible to read about some of the artists who made the ivory figurines?
Yes, you can read them. Do we have anything? No.
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 So if you want to know, like, a particular artist who made something...
No...
Well, thank you very much, Melanie.
Well, you're welcome, honey. I mean, like I said, everything is Native made. You can see it.
Right.
Yeah.
After that, I visit a place with a shelf full of suspiciously dusty Eskimo dolls.
That's a little expensive, $70 or $80.
Yes.
Yes.
And another that's selling tchotchkes, but nothing they're passing off as Alaska Native art.
There's a gallery over here on this corner.
There's a Native gallery right there.
Yeah, it's on the corner on 6th over there.
That gallery they're referring to? It's the Alaska Native Arts Foundation Gallery, back where I started. So you see, it can be tricky. Whether you're a longtime Alaskan, a tourist on a cruise, or just a casual collector, keep your eyes open and don't be afraid to ask questions. If you do suspect foul play at a shop or on the internet, you can file a confidential complaint with the Federal Trade Commission, the Indian Arts and Crafts Board, the Alaska Attorney General's Office, or the Alaska State Council on the Arts. They all can help determine whether something's on the up and up or downright fake. In Anchorage, I'm Rebecca Shear.
So grateful for your listening time today, and there is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 with more Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.